Welcome to Sate.
Okay.
A podcast about the foods that have shaped Malaysia. I'm Dr. Nobby Leong, scientist, food writer, and broadcaster.
And I'm Philip Gibson, photographer and coconut shy champion.
And in this series, we explore the history, cultures, and cuisines of Malaysia, from the ancient lands of Southeast Asia all the way through to the creation of a modern day nation. In today's episode, we take a look at coconuts and the land before borders. So get ready to put a lime in the coconut because it's time for Sate.
Okay.
So in the last episode, we looked at durian and the arrival of the first people. So for me, durian is this really beautiful culinary connection. Reminds us of how ancient and old the lands of Southeast Asia actually are. And durian is that food that intrinsically connects us to the jungle, to the animals, to its people. And we took a look at indigenous Orang Asli culture. So in today's episode, we're looking at coconuts and the land before borders. And so we're jumping forward in time to about 2000 years ago-ish. And we're going to explore how events at that time influence our understanding of both Malay culture and cuisine, as well as Southeast Asian culture and cuisine as a whole. But first, let's talk coconuts.
Coconuts. Well, I guess for me, my first introduction to it would have been the humble Bounty Bar. But, you know,
beyond... Love a Bounty Bar.
Love Bounty Bar. Well, beyond that, though, as a fresh ingredient, I think of it as, you know, probably Caribbean. But then I also think, well, surely coconut milk's used in a lot of Indian curries. So it's used across the world.
Yeah, it's one of those, like, global foods because so many coastal communities around the world, no matter which continent you're from,
sure,
has coconuts.
Yeah.
It does hold particular significance in a lot of Malaysian cultures, cuisines.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Whether that's Malay, Indian, and even the Chinese communities in Malaysia use coconuts to some degree.
It's quite versatile as well, isn't it? From the water and the flesh and all of the rest of it.
Well, yeah, exactly.
It's... You would even use the fronds for like roofing and stuff like that as well,
yeah,
right? Like thatched roofs or whatever.
Yeah, this plant is amazing. This fruit is amazing. Like, you know, the coconut is a fruit. Mm. You can eat the flesh of it. You can drink the water. Mm. You can like mash up the flesh and extract the milk and the oils.
And the fats, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so there's so many different ways that it's used. Yeah, coconuts are used a lot in particular Malay cuisine. So rendang, which is I guess a dry coconut curry.
Yeah.
And it's basically made by, you know, making a spice paste, as you would so many Malay curries, adding coconut milk and then boiling it down until it's really, really dry.
There was this other ingredient when I've been trying to make rendang called kerisik, which is where you basically take desiccated coconut, toast it almost to the point of blackening, and then you traditionally would take a mortar and pestle and for hours would mash it and mash it and mash it into this kind of like, not quite peanut butter, but it's this really thick...
Well, all the oils, I guess, start getting released from the coconut flesh, and then it kind of becomes like a runny peanut butter.
Right, yeah.
In that context.
Yeah, it's quite pasty, almost like fudgy or almost something. Like, but when I added it to the rendang when I was making it, I don't know if you know what I mean when I say that when you're making curry, it's better to have it the next day. Those flavors need to sit for a bit and just kind of really start to mature whatever in the pot. But then when I add the kerisik to it, it almost adds this like instant depth to it because I think you've charred it, but you've also released those oils and it's probably quite sweet as well with all the caramelization that's going on in the toasting. And that's just like another kind of like coconut product that I've added to dishes that has completely changed the complexity of the dish. And it's quite simple. It's literally just desiccated coconut that you have almost burnt and then mashed it up into a paste.
Yeah, yeah.
It's quite amazing.
But then there's also desserts that use coconut. So ondeh ondeh, which is sort of this like mochi-like dessert, but it's covered in desiccated coconut. So it's used in lots of savory dishes like curries, like stews, and it's used in lots of sweet dishes, whether that's the desiccated coconut, but we also have like coconut-based jellies.
Oh yeah.
That we like called kuih lapis. But even though it's used so ubiquitously in Malay cuisine, I think it's a little understated. Like last episode, we were talking about durians and that's got massive brand awareness.
Sure.
And when people say durian, they kind of immediately think of either Malaysia or Southeast Asia in general.
Yeah.
But I think when people think about coconuts, they don't necessarily think about Southeast Asia. And probably for that reason you mentioned at the beginning, that it's everywhere in the world. But what many people don't realize is that Southeast Asia was one of the original sites of coconut cultivation.
As in, is that where they came from?
I don't want to say the words, that's where they came from. Mainly because I don't think there's been enough research of like of the first coconut.
Right.
Okay. I don't know if they've done that. However, scientists have analyzed coconuts around the world. And in 2011, there was a paper released called Independent Origins of Cultivated Coconut that tried to find out where coconut was first cultivated.
Okay.
So not originated as sort of a wild plant, but where was it cultivated most? And so they did DNA analysis of like 1,300 coconuts from around the world.
Okay.
A lot of coconuts.
It's like, what was that, 23andMe for coconuts?
Exactly. Okay. And what they found is that coconuts really originated in cultivation from two main sites.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was the Southeast Asia region. So what we mean by that is like Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, those sorts of areas.
Okay.
And then the other origin of cultivation was the Indian Ocean area. So we're thinking the coastal areas of India, Sri Lanka, but also places like the Maldives.
Not a million miles away though, really, from Southeast Asia, given how buoyant the coconuts are famously of traveling across the sea, which is probably how they've dispersed themselves.
Well, that's almost like the myth of coconuts, that a lot of people think that because coconuts float, they have independently traveled the globe.
Well, they're sentient now.
Yeah, they're sentient, yeah.
Okay.
But what the researchers of this paper suggest is that coconuts from Southeast Asia were carried to the Indian Ocean by seafarers about 2,000 years ago.
Okay.
And then those two sites, the Southeast Asian coconuts and the Indian Ocean coconuts, were eventually transported to the rest of the world, to the Americas, to Africa, by European traders.
Oh, so not under their own steam?
No.
Right, okay. I feel like there's been a lot of like analogies about these coconuts being quite self-determined seafarers up the Straits of Malacca and on their way to wherever, the Coromandel Coast or something. Like
what's
that
Tom Hanks movie? Castaway. Yeah, Castaway.
Oh yeah, Wilson. Well, that was a volleyball, was it not?
Wilson was a volleyball, man. Maybe Wilson had some friends.
Maybe.
That were coconuts that became sentient.
Right.
Yeah, and left Wilson on that island by himself.
With Tom Hanks, right.
Okay. So given this almost botanical migration that has accompanied human migration, I think we need to kind of like bolster the status of coconuts and what that means to the people of not just Malaysia, but of Southeast Asia.
Is bolstering the status though, I feel like they have status, but they're just underappreciated.
Yeah.
Because they are ubiquitous, I think it's like they need to be celebrated more, I think is what you're saying. They're under-acknowledged, they're underappreciated.
Yeah.
We care about appreciation. So,
we care about appreciation.
Yeah, so we care about coconut appreciation on this show.
Yeah. So let's cast our minds back to about a couple of thousand years ago. Mm-hmm. So by this stage, the first peoples have already arrived, been there for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the ancestors of Malay people have first arrived, and the ancestors of all these other indigenous groups have been there and settled for quite some time. You know, they've got communities there. But at this point in time, there's no such thing as countries.
Right.
So there's no Malaysia, Singapore, Brunei, Indonesia, Philippines, whatever. Mm-hmm. There's no such thing as borders.
Right, yeah.
And so the movement of people is pretty fluid.
Right.
And so because all of these people, particularly on the coastal areas, were seafarers, they were going back and forth around the areas of Southeast Asia and also potentially around the world too. And so as a little reminder, Southeast Asia has 25,000 islands.
Exactly.
Exactly 25,000, not an island more. So people at that time, they were perhaps trading with people of other islands and other lands. They were sharing culture, sharing language, marrying each other, forging bonds. So this is the beginning of perhaps our recognizable culture of what we call Malay culture, Indonesian culture, Filipino culture.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them have the same history.
Right.
And we can see that in the food of these Southeast Asian nations. Like, if you think about Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, we all have a form of coconut rice.
Okay.
So for example, in Malaysia, we have nasi lemak, which is like the national dish, and that is coconut rice served with sambal, peanuts, cucumber, and fried fish.
But we found that in Indonesia as well.
it's in Indonesia as well.
Mm.
And then in Thailand, I'm not sure if they have nasi lemak, but they certainly have glutinous rice cooked in coconut milk, and that becomes a dessert to serve with mango. So all of these cultures of Southeast Asia have coconut as the core, because we've got this thousands of year old history of sharing culture through seafaring traditions.
The more you know.
The more you know. And so I think in today's age, we sort of forget that, because we've got these defined countries now. These countries are like, oh, I'm Malaysian and I'm Indonesian, which is fair enough. Mm. We sort of forget that they do have a shared history. They do have a shared culture. And I think it's only now in recent years that we're maybe starting to recognize that.
That it's shared.
That it's shared. Yeah. More openly recognize that and appreciate that, because we're about appreciation. Now we have to think about, how do we actually go about recognizing the shared history and culture? How do we talk about it? What terms do we use?
Breaking bread with your old neighbors.
It's, yeah.
breaking rice, maybe.
Breaking rice, yeah.
Breaking coconuts in today's episode.
How do we break coconuts so that we acknowledge this past and also preserve this shared culture as well? Because if people aren't talking about the shared culture, then it'll kind of be consigned to the history books.
I think so. It's unifying, isn't it? Or it should be unifying. It shouldn't be divisive.
Exactly. So I want to introduce you to a new term that can help us in better talking about this shared past. And that term is Nusantara. In the context of talking about the ancient past, Nusantara refers to all the islands of Southeast Asia, most of them.
Okay, as far out as it to the Philippines? Or
Philippines,
is it...
Borneo, Malaysia, yeah. Singapore, Indonesia, perhaps parts of New Guinea, and parts of southern Thailand as well.
Okay.
So collectively, some people are starting to refer to these lands as Nusantara.
Okay.
And the other terms that people are starting to use, not all the time, is the idea of Malay culture and Malay world, not just to refer to people of Malaysia.
Okay.
But in a broader understanding, because remember that Malay culture grew out of a time before borders.
Right, okay. That is an interesting concept, without wanting to jump too far ahead in time. When you think about, you know, even just on the island of Java, you've got Sundanese and you've got other kind of like ethnic groups of people that are more clustered within regions, even on one island.
Yeah.
But this, as a Malay culture, because is it argued that the Malay people perhaps came from various Southeast Asian... I guess this is what you're talking about. It's all of the sea trade. It's the back and forth. Yeah. It's people moving around. And yeah, it's murky.
Yeah, it's really murky. I don't think Nusantara and Malay world are easy concepts to digest.
And we are also not experts.
And we're not experts, but there are people that are experts, and we're going to talk to them now.
Thank God for academics.
So we spoke to Kia Jahari, who's a prominent voice in discussions about Nusantara and Malay culture. He's the author of a book called The Food of Singapore Malays, Gastronomic Travels Through the Archipelago. So this book is not just about the Malay people of Singapore, but it's the Malay people of the entire Southeast Asian archipelago. Those perhaps 25,000 islands.
Got it. Okay.
I spoke to him via Zoom from his home in Singapore.
Well, you know, I'm Kira Johari. I have always been interested in food because there's so much more to food than what we eat. Right? It's who we are, kind of identity, our history, our place in the region. So there's something about food. Simply put, Malay cuisine is food. That's cuisine that's created, prepared, consumed according to the distinctive cultural norms of the Malay people, regardless of their geographical, national, ethnic, or racial origins. You know, it's deeply, you know, deeply rooted in the region, you know, and yet very cosmopolitan. You know, there's a book by Tim Barnard, Professor Tim Barnard, called Contesting Malayness, right? I mean, there's this, you know, you can go in so many directions. But for the purpose of my book, And I wanted to look at Malay not as an ethno-racial entity, but a sort of fluid space, multicultural fluid space. Let's take a look at the word Roman. When someone says that's very Roman, it could well be it could be something Gaulish or Egyptian, it could be Greek, and yet we know it. We knew it as something that's very Roman. So likewise, Malay world really a maritime space. With endless shores and all this mixing, especially in port cities, you're bound to see this colourful foodscape.
The foodscape of Nusantara is of particular interest to Kia, and he explained to me the many different cultural influences and culinary features of Nusantara.
Nusantara, if you were to break it down, it's from Sanskrit, that's a Nusa, that's island, Antara in between, so islands in between. So that's the archipelago. This is a maritime world. You have the Austronesians up north. There's a Chinese civilization which has always been trading with Nusantara, the Malay world. And then we have to the west, we have India, the Indian subcontinent. We have the arrival of people from the Middle East and the Persianate world. So yes, the Malay world is the Nusantara. Imagine, that there is a little pond here and you're consuming something yummy. I look across, I think, I want to eat what you're eating. I want to know what's that in your hand. I think people, there's something about, great ideas travel. We interact, we want to experiment. And there's something also about the nature of the archipelago. Hospitality, warmth, and the love of trying something different, something new. So the Malay world itself is such a mosaic. There's so many different subgroups. So when we could look within the big umbrella, the Malay world umbrella, there's that Malay sub-ethnic group called Malay itself. Yep. And there's, of course, the Javanese and the Bugis, the Minangkabau, the Batak, the Achenese. So and we know also that there's all this regional food. So when you mentioned about Orang Asli or Orang Daya, to me, I look at it as if it's a regional subgroup, with its own food. But again, it's. When we talk about food, it's never mutually exclusive. Through interaction, there's bound to be commonalities. They're bound because the interaction allows for cross-pollination. When you look at the Mediterranean, the Levantine, or North Africa, or Western Europe, there is a distinctive culture about Mediterranean region. Likewise, in the Malay world, there's multi-ethnicity within the Malay world. You expect to see this sophistication, this mixing of ingredients and also techniques and symbolisms.
So yeah, from my interpretation of what Kia was saying, it's like Malay culture and Malay cuisine, I guess by extension, is an umbrella term to describe lots of different either subcultures, regional cultures that originated in Nusantara.
But I also liked his comparison to Mediterranean, because to me, certainly as a European, would think of as a Mediterranean culture is that, islandy sort of a thing, whether it's in Spain or whether it's in France or Greece or can't really speak about Tunisia or anywhere on the North African side, but it's
you think of a lifestyle, you think of specific cultural elements.
I think of yachts, but but again, I guess that's a nice comparison because it's about sea trade and seafaring people, I guess. Not just the super rich, but I can contextualize what he's saying about the Malaysian stuff with an idea of the Roman Empire and any Grecian empires or Egyptian empires or Ottoman Empire, even about just that, the sharing of ideas. It's not just food all the time, but it's, art and design, it's architecture, it's, religion probably. Mm-hmm. And
those empires spread across what we now call multiple countries.
Right, have then obviously fractured off into their own cultures and things like that, but
they still have got this shared history.
Right. Yeah. And it's undeniable. You see all the ruins of all of these cultures that have come before.
So it's pretty clear from the chat with Kia that he does have this deep passion for food and where it comes from. So I wanted to know a little bit more about Kia himself. What prompted him to write The Food of Singapore Malays and what his plans for the future are if we're talking about acknowledging Nusantara more and preserving that culture?
you know, my background is mathematics. And I've been, you know, and in math, there's so much more to math than just numbers. I always encourage my students to look at math history to make more math more meaningful. How do you know what you know? There's always that question in mathematics. How do you know what you know, right? So likewise, if I were to take that, you know, and transfer that to food, there's so much to unpack. And I felt there was a sense of, how do I put it, social responsibility to need to want to document. And hence I embarked on this project. I think there's always been that foundation, you know, that love for food and the sense of curiosity. I felt very strongly that if there's a book that I want to read but has not been written, I need to write it. Yeah.
The Food of Singapore Malays was published in 2021 and has become an instant classic. And Kia says that the topics around our shared history have never been more important.
Why is it important today? There was a time when we just gained independence, whether, you know, when we say we Indonesia or Malaya gained independence, we were sort of busy forging, you know, our identity. But now, you know, with ASEAN, you know, with movement of people, and, you know, people are rediscovering a lot of things about themselves. So I think all the more it's necessary to understand who we are. It's interesting that when the book came out, I thought I was looking forward to a review from Business Times and South China Morning Post. It didn't happen. But the first review came out of Germany from the University of Greifswald. And this professor said, so we in the Baltic should be looking at this book to have that kind of conversation. Mm-hmm. Whether you're Estonian, whether you're German or Russian or Polish, we share the same water, the same climate. We understand what to do with cabbage to get ready for the winter. So, look, this book is talking about that. It's a trans-regional understanding to look at food beyond, you know, modern-day states. You know, it should transcend, you know, geopolitical boundaries.
Yeah.
So, and I felt that when I gave my launch in Jakarta, People were curious about this book, you know, with the subtitle, you know, Gastronomic Travel Through the Archipelago. And I said, this is not a cookbook. It's a love story that's lost and we are about to rediscover. Now that the book is out, you know, it's like a baby, you want to watch the baby grow. And I felt there was need for more sort of conversation, hence starting Dialogues by Kier and the first project, the first big project, that's a seminar called Serumpun. Serumpun simply means one cluster. You know, when you describe, for example, your lemongrass or your bamboo, we know it comes from one cluster, one rumpun, but it has many branches. Mm-hmm. So it's a lovely metaphor for the Malay world. I felt very strongly there was a need for intergenerational transmission. Mm-hmm. How do you go about doing it? So having Serumpun as a platform, you know, and to hear, you know, various perspectives, and that's really wonderful. I think the best way to keep traditions alive is to create spaces where they can be shared, questioned, reinterpreted, and leave, and not just look at. And, you know, one of the driving, you know, intentions behind Serumpun is to bring together people from across the Nusantara to share not just knowledge, but live experiences. And that's the reason why I felt very strongly, you know, we need that platform to hear from scholars, to hear from practitioners, to hear from young bloggers, and anyone is interested in food, to come together. Because, you know, culture survives not because it's preserved perfectly, but because it is loved, remembered, and reimagined. One of the speakers at Serumpun, the first Serumpun we had in October, spoke about food wars, and it was so hilarious because when you listen with an open mind, you realize just it's silly, it's futile. The notion of a national identity is a modern creation, especially in the Nusantara. I mean, you know, you could be from Palembang, your mother-in-law is from Kelantan.
Keir stressed, though, that conferences like Serumpun are just one aspect of acknowledging and preserving culture. There are many other ways that everyday people can play a part.
You know, like many, all many, you know, like many good things, you know, we talk about charity begins at home. Our food consumption, our love for food, that has to be, you need to have that conversation around your dining table, right? It's not just, how's the food, Nobi? And Nobi replied, it's great. So the next question should be, why do you think it's great? Can you guess what's in this dish? And you know, does this remind you of something else? Have you had prior experience something similar to this? So that conversation needs to be had. So it starts from home. You know, mom, you know, comes home from the market and say, okay, look at this. This is called cardamom. Yeah, I say, do you want to try this? I say, mom, well, look at the aroma. Then start the conversation. I think it's a good starter. You know, it's better to have something on the table and a conversation about, you know, food than not to have. Meaning that, you know, yes, your people are busy, you know, going through, you know, sort of daily grind. But, you know, let's say you go to the hawker center, you buy something from outside, from the mama's store, you buy a packet of meat, of chicken rice home. But still, you can still have that conversation. But ideally, it would be great to have people, you know, in the kitchen. That is something that's really, you know, we celebrate our hawker culture. But what's lacking, I think, it's home cooking. Whenever that's possible. I don't mind making ota-ota, let's say, in a Pyrex. If I cannot do my ota-ota, you know, the fronds of the coconut leaves, I might not have the luxury of time. Yeah. So I would still do my ota-ota. At least it's there. Yeah.
So for those that don't know, otak-otak is a fish dish. It's fish that's blended with spices to make a paste, and then it's wrapped in leaves and grilled. But rather than undertaking that extra effort of sourcing and wrapping leaves, Keir cooks his otak-otak in a baking dish. I asked Keir to expand on this idea of taking shortcuts and adapting recipes. Is it okay to mess with tradition like that?
No, I think that people shouldn't have that fear of, you know, of doing something. Because at the end of the day, you know, recipes are guidelines. It guides you through the process. So if I'm going to improvise, if I'm going to use ingredients that's available in London, you know, it calls for instance, the recipe calls for aromatic galangal, which I cannot get in London. Can I make do with something else? Can I, you know, apply some kind of adaptation? Can I localize it? So I think you shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't fear. It's way better than losing, you know, who you are. I mean, losing your cuisine, losing your food.
Yeah.
I want to see the survival of that recipe. Mm-hmm. I want to see the survival of that particular dish. It can take a different form. Mm-hmm. I was in Sri Lanka and I saw a book on the rawon. Rawon is the mother of the buah keluak that we know, ayam buah keluak. Mm-hmm. It's an East Javanese dish. But there's something was glaring in that recipe for rawon. The very thing that makes rawon, the buah keluak, isn't there because it's not available in Sri Lanka. But it exists, it survived in its name. At least I know there is rawon. And it's a reminder also, a story of Javanese that, you know, that got exiled or made their way to Sri Lanka.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm big for that. I like to look at it positively. Things might just get, you know, it might not be in its quote-unquote sort of a pure state, but I'm happy to make do. Happy to use.
So that was Keir Johari, author of The Food of Singapore Malays. Philip, what did you make of that conversation?
I really enjoyed what he was talking about with the German academic having read the book and then going like, oh, we do that in Europe as well because we know how to prepare cabbage dishes to get us through winter and all the rest of it. What I actually think about with that is Jewish food, because Jewish culture is quite nomadic across Europe, I think, in that sort of a way. It's always been on the move, but that food has been left in places or been introduced to it.
Yeah, and I think when I first came across this concept of Nusantara and the shared history of Southeast Asia, I think I got unnecessarily confused by it, possibly because it was all these new terms and new ideas, when really these ideas are quite common around the world, whether it's Baltic states, Mediterranean states. There's so many examples around the world where countries that we know today actually have a shared culture that goes back thousands of years.
Right. I mean, yeah, I mean, it is that kind of peasant food, isn't it? Like, well, that's what we would call it in Europe anyway. But like, you know, people are absolutely hearkening back to this, like, comfort food that these hearty, you know, provincial, whatever the fuck you want to romanticize it as. Yeah, I guess that's the comparison that should be easy for people to make without having to... Kira's talking very specifically about dishes that I'm aware that anybody outside of Malaysia or Indonesia will not know what he was talking about, but there are dishes that we have here. You know,
yeah.
All these soups and stews. Like, you know,
fish and chips.
Yeah, even the way we make our bread. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. And I think it's so important to acknowledge this, because as Kira was mentioning, our food culture is fading. People are cooking less. Dishes are at risk of not surviving. So the more we can kind of come together, the better, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's... I was chatting with a friend recently who is from Guinea-Bissau, and he was saying that he wanted to cook his mother's food and all the rest of it, but it's similar to what he was saying about the availability of those ingredients that you cannot... like West African ingredients that you cannot get in markets in Glasgow. But as you said, you've got to cook it to keep it. And so...
cook it to keep it. Put that on a tote bag.
Put that on a tote bag. And I think, you know, even if you can't get it, if it's close enough, how many tens of thousands of recipes are there for spaghetti bolognese?
Yeah.
Right? And so, but people are just going to put their mince in the pan. Do they have celery? Probably not. But they're going to maybe put a carrot and onion through it and certainly like a can of tomatoes, which is not how you should do it, apparently. But it's just that way. You're making that dish that... to you is spaghetti bolognese, because the version that I grew up with, my parents cook it and they're not Italian. That is like, I mean, the way my nana makes it is different. It's just like, I want to taste what my parents and my grandmother's cooking was.
Yeah.
Even if it's not right, even if it's thoroughly bastardized. Yeah. There's a memory there. It's a love of family almost that comes through recreating those dishes that you grew up with. So people need to stop being so precious and stop being so absolutist about how a dish should be, because even in Malaysia, you go one village over and they'd cook it differently, right? But they'd still call it nasi goreng.
Because I think culture exists on a spectrum and our dishes exist on a spectrum, and there are many ways to make something authentic and traditional depending on lots of different factors.
Right.
So I just want to mention, we've been using the word Nusantara to describe ancient Southeast Asia. But Nusantara does mean different things depending on which country you're in. So in Malaysia, Nusantara more likely means the archipelago. Mm-hmm. In Indonesia, Nusantara can either mean just the Indonesian archipelago, or it can mean the new capital city of Indonesia that's currently being built on the island of Borneo.
Yeah, their Kalimantan side. Yeah.
So just be aware that when you read Nusantara on the internet or in books, it can mean different things. The other thing I'll say is that not everyone likes to use actually the word Nusantara. Some people prefer to say maritime Southeast Asia to refer to those ancient lands and those ancient people.
That seems like a more PC way of doing it.
Yeah, and some people prefer to say ASEAN. So that's Association of Southeast Asian Nations.
But that reaches all the way up to Vietnam, Cambodia. Is that still in that catch-all?
Oh, look, but potentially, you know, I'm not an academic in it. And maybe as more research and more conversations happen, maybe we're expanding our idea of what Nusantara actually is, what maritime Southeast Asia actually is. So the other thing I'll mention is that not everyone also likes the word Malay world or Malay culture as that catch-all umbrella.
Right.
Because Malay is so associated with Malaysia now, you can see why not everyone likes that.
Right. Yeah, you need like a neutral term.
Yeah. So as we move to, you know, recognizing and appreciating our shared history and culture, I'm sure we'll see more conversations about what terms people prefer to use. So far, we've mainly been talking about cooking and dishes when talking about culture and our food culture. But really, it's not just those two things. It's also about, I guess, our botanical heritage.
Okay.
And the plants that we actually rely upon. And how do people usually get those plants was through foraging.
Right.
And so that's another aspect of our food culture that we're losing in at greater risk.
Certainly with urbanization, like we're going to have less market gardeners and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, like who do you know that can forage anywhere in the world?
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, allotments are becoming a big thing over here, but like that is such a kind of like pastime of the middle classes, isn't it?
But that's a garden. That's right. Gardening.
Cultivation. Right. Yeah. 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 So we can't walk into woodland and know where to find whatever we're looking for.
Yeah. If you're enjoying this episode, you can follow us on social media at SateOK. We'll be sharing beautiful photos taken by Philip of Malaysia, its people, and of course, the food. We'll also share photos of Malaysia from the archives, so you can see how the country has changed over time. You can also find links to give us a tip or donation to show your appreciation for the work we're doing. So head to our socials at SateOK or visit our website, sateok.com. So to find out more about foraging and our botanical heritage, we spoke to Maria Stephanie, a food researcher and writer based in Yogyakarta in Indonesia. And because she's from Indonesia, when she mentions Nusantara in this interview, she's referring to the Indonesian archipelago and not the broader maritime Southeast Asia.
Well, my full name is Maria Stephanie, but you can call me Steffi. Like most Indonesians, we don't really go by the first name basis. Like sometimes our nickname comes from our middle name. Anyway, it's a long story, but anyway, you can call me Steffi. And I'm, how would I describe what I do for a living? Maybe a food researcher and food writer. So my main focus, I guess, is food plants, especially like local food plants, so not necessarily indigenous or native species, but everything that grows locally in Indonesia and that have been embraced by the locals in Indonesia as, you know, as an everyday food source. So for those of you who don't know, Indonesia is the second most biodiverse country in the world. So we have, more than 10,000 species of plants, and I'm not really sure like how much of it is edible, but yeah, we do have a lot of edible plants, but they're currently are underutilized because now like our food options are very limited to a handful of species, as you know, right? But you know, back in the days, back in the olden days, we used to have like a very varied diet with lots of, you know, edible plants. But now the knowledge of these plants are diminishing. Partly, I think, is because like because we're now doing well in terms of, you know, the economy, and yeah, we just more like politically stable. We're not in our like survival mode. Like back in the days, like post-war, World War II, like you said about, you know, Britain being poor after the Second World War, we also experienced that. We were very poor. We had very limited food that like our predecessors, they had to be creative with where they get their food sources. So they would go to the forest. They would like try to remember what their ancestors ate, like all the wild edibles. Or for example, like with the banana tree, you can actually eat the banana blossoms, right? We still do, but it's not a very common thing to eat anymore. So those kind of things, you know, that kind of knowledge, that diminishing, we're losing that. But like I view that kind of knowledge as, like, knowledge is wealth, right? Yeah, so when you're losing like a certain amount of knowledge, you're actually becoming poorer.
The number of forageable wild plants is vast, and Steffi shared with me just a few.
There are certain types of weeds that you can easily find on the like side of the roads, or like growing near the rice paddies. There's one called, in Indonesian it's called sirih cina or sirih air. I think it's a type of wild pepper.
Betel leaf.
Betel leaf, yeah. that one you can find easily. And then there's also pagagan. Pagagan is go-to kola is the Indian name for pagagan. Those would be the two most common examples of plants that you can forage easily in Jogja.
In Jogja.
And you can use you can eat them raw, use them as a salad leaf, mm-hmm. or you can also lightly blanch them and make like a traditional Javanese salad with peanut sauce, mm-hmm. pechal. We call it pechal.
These forage foods can be used to make many more dishes. And I asked Steffi on some of her favorites.
On the top of my mind, I would say one of them is called trancam. Mm-hmm. So it's a funny one because for people who are not familiar with this dish, mm-hmm. trancam means threatened in Indonesian, mm-hmm. but in Javanese, it means something else. It's the name of this dish.
Oh.
But for people who are not, for Indonesian people who are not familiar with this dish, they would be like, you know, mm-hmm. trancam, like, uh-huh. why would I want to be threatened? Yeah. Now, anyway, that's another story. But yeah, why I like trancam in particular is because it's, okay, so it's basically a traditional salad, Javanese salad, mm-hmm. made with, originally it was, it used to be made with foraged greens, but mm-hmm. nowadays mm-hmm. with, you know, farm produce mm-hmm. mostly, but we still get, like, if we go to some places that would still use forage produce, mm-hmm. right? So they're mostly raw, and then it's dressed with coconut dressing. Mm-hmm. So it's shaved coconut mm-hmm. with some spices tossed together, and also palm sugar. So it's sweet and a bit spicy and a bit savory as well from the coconut and from the salt. And you just mix everything together, and it creates this most delicious, most beautiful salad that you can just eat it on its own, mm-hmm. or with a plate of rice and, you know, some sides, tempeh or tofu. That would be one of my top three plant-based traditional dishes.
For Steffi, preserving the skill of foraging and regaining our understanding of wild foods is more than just about cultural and culinary preservation. It's also about everyday health.
Health benefits, lowered risk of cardiovascular diseases, diabetes. So all of these, what do you call them again? Metabolic diseases?
Metabolic
diseases. Degenerative diseases as well. So yeah, lowered risks of these kind of diseases.
Yeah.
And also, you know, the simple joys of life of having to poop every day, every morning.
Yeah.
Like regular bowel movement, you would say. Yeah. I was going to say, yeah, it impacts your mood. So if you don't go this morning, then you feel crappy the whole day.
Digestive benefits aside, the botanical and foraging aspects of cuisine and culture is a really tricky one to keep alive. And that's because unlike dishes that are cooked, where recipes can be adapted, you can't really do that with forage produce. Preserving this culture really depends on where you live.
Like if you live in a very, like an urban setting, an urban area, a highly dense population with almost no forest, it's not impossible, but it's very difficult for you to be able to forage your own food, foods. But if you live like in the villages, you can still do that. But then again, if you can still do that if you still have the knowledge about the edible plants. But if you have very limited knowledge, then well, you still can forage, but then you're just limiting yourself to this, you know, small number of plants. Mm. But still, like the question remains, like where can I get these? Where can I forage my food? Mm-hmm. Like where can I forage my wild vegetables from? So it's still a question that we collectively have to answer.
While the act of foraging and finding wild foods isn't necessarily practical for a lot of people, gaining that knowledge is something that can be addressed, no matter where you live. And that's what Steffi is trying to achieve with her book about the plants and foods of Indonesia.
It's called Dari Bumi Nusantara ke Piring Kita. So in English, the English translation would be from Nusantara soil to our plate. And because like the book that I've just published is actually targeted for the younger audience, mm-hmm. like maybe primary school students. So I'm hoping that this knowledge gets passed down to the younger generation.
Yeah. Again, it wasn't just culture that motivated her to write the book. It was about health too.
I guess it's partly sustenance and also partly health. Mm. Health concerns. Sustenance because like during the COVID times, we mainly had to stay at home, and I was lucky because I lived with my parents during COVID, and they have like a small garden where they have they have these edible plants that are quite rare nowadays, and I can still buy vegetables from the nearby vegetable vendor, but you know, sometimes I would get too lazy to go outside, and then just, hey, we have this vegetable growing in our garden. Why don't we just use this? So it's like during that time that I realized that we could actually live on this knowledge. You know, we could actually survive on this knowledge. But yeah, that is one, the sustenance, and then health because I'm interested in gut health. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nowadays, we just don't eat enough fiber. Mm. Like, I just, having this knowledge about this edible plants is useful for me, because when I feel bored, then I can just go to my garden and pick something up, you know, pick something from my garden and then eat them.
Researching the book required Steffi to engage with older generations who had that knowledge of the local environment. We talked about the process of approaching this generation, and it was really interesting to hear about the dynamic between older and younger generations.
Well, they're actually quite happy to share, because they don't get asked these questions nowadays. So you can imagine that these are people who are well over their, you know, 50s. They're those who survived and lived through the post-war era. The thing is, right, they have this assumption that the younger generation just don't really, are not really interested in this type of knowledge anymore. But when you ask the younger generation, they would say that, oh, you know, those old people just don't want to share anything with us anymore. So there's this assumption barrier between these two generations now. So, and also I think because most Indonesians, we were not accustomed to asking questions. Like if you don't know anything, you just keep quiet. In Western countries, if you don't know something, you ask, right? You ask because you want to know, right? So having to introduce this method of research is also something new, I guess. But I find that with a lot of people who I asked about these things, they're very open to sharing their knowledge. It's just that we have to ask them. We have to ask these questions. We have to be brave enough to ask.
There's another layer to this though, and Steffi did encounter some people that didn't really want to talk or share their knowledge, and the reason was quite unexpected.
Oh, and there's also sometimes you do get a level of hesitancy from some people, especially in Jawa, because we have this concept, I don't know how you can translate it into English. Gengsi. Apa gengsi? Pride, yeah. You know, when we want to find out about these, like, forage produce, like the older population, the older generation would think of these forage produce as poor people's food. Yeah, like wartime food. So it's, many of them associate these produce with, you know, the tough times, post-war tough times. So it's like a unpleasant memory that they don't want to relive. I don't think it's shame. It's just that they, It's just that they don't want to be reminded that they were once poor and suffering. It could be trauma. It could be something traumatic, but at the same time, it could be something nostalgic as well. For example, my dad, he grew up very poor, but he would, when we eat out, go to this restaurant where they serve maybe like fish, grilled fish, right? And then we just start eating, and then he would start telling stories about his childhood, like where when he was very poor, if he wanted to eat fish, he would go to the nearest river and bring his fishing rod, and then you know he just went fishing, and then he caught some and bring back home, and then he would grill the fish and eat the entirety of the fish, mm-hmm. except for the bones, of course, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's, you know, that kind of like, if I would ask my dad purposely to get this kind of stories, maybe he would feel a bit hesitant, but you know, like you have to have this, a certain atmosphere for him to kind of, able to get these stories out, uh-huh. without him having to remember the, you know, bad memories, traumatic memories,
Solution to bridging the generational gap and bridging the knowledge gap is that to create spaces where you incidentally talk about these things rather than a formal question and answer forum. Do you think there are like community spaces that people can build that enable just the free flow of information?
Actually, I'd never thought of that, but that's a good idea, actually. that is a very good idea. I never thought of that. You know, like having a dedicated space, like a safe space for us to be able to share stories. Yeah. And also, I think shifting the narrative a bit could help as well. Like, you tried to put these like food sources in a very positive light. Like, for example, if I talk about gut health, if I talk about health in general, and then I tell people that, hey, do you know that this is rich in this substance, that chemicals that can help, you know, prevent this diseases, like blah, 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 blah. And they're, hey, I used to eat that before, like in the olden days. And that would get people started with these stories. Yeah, like, if you try to kind of shift the narrative a bit, the perspective,
The challenges inspiring the next generation are getting harder, though, year on year. And there are a lot of factors to consider.
I think we're losing it at a very quick pace. Yeah, and that's a shame. Because the older generations are slowly dying out.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, and then also with the current, like, food trends, like, especially people who live in bigger cities, they're getting more and more detached from traditional foods. Like more and more younger generations are getting more familiar with like Korean food, like modern Korean food, of course, Korean street food, Japanese street food, but like they don't know what aram-aram is or timu is, right? So yeah.
Steffi though reiterated the same points that Kia made, that in order for traditions to be preserved and practiced, we need to loosen up and modernize.
Getting creative with these forage produce could help a lot. Like, how can we embrace and incorporate these foraged foods into our modern day diet? Because like, we have to acknowledge that nowadays people don't consume the same foods as people back in the olden days, and it's fine. Like you're allowed to be creative with food. But then there's also like a group of people who want to cling to the past and say that you can only eat this when it's cooked like that. You know, like they're very strict about tradition, and traditionality. But I think the solution is to be creative.
So that was Maria Stephanie, and her book is available through her publisher, Guru Bumi, and it can also be bought online on Tokopedia, but it is in Indonesian, and she doesn't currently have an English version or any other languages.
It is a beautiful book, though. The illustrations throughout it are absolutely incredible, and I don't know if a version of that exists in the UK for what can be forged in the UK.
Oh yeah, that'd be interesting. What did you make of her conversation?
I thought it was really interesting. I think what also stuck out for me, which was similar to Ronnie in our previous episode talking about ancestors being reluctant to kind of share on that knowledge, is just such an interesting thing about trying to just kind of present themselves in a new image, and we're not going to look back to the past or whatever it is, kind of like for fear of being nostalgic almost. But then, as she says, you know, you get them down at the dinner table to be eating that particular fish or whatever, and then he just wants to actually start sharing all of these things. I thought that was really interesting, and
I think it's
funny, this kind of starting to be this recurrence of like hesitancy about sharing the past and sharing the old practices and things.
I don't think I really thought about it in terms of trauma, though, and she was sort of talking about the reluctance because they didn't want to be reminded of a really bad time. And I remember talking to my mum about her growing up in Malaysia, and whenever she'd talk about it, she'd really just be like, oh, we were so poor, really, really poor, but she wouldn't really
expand on it.
Yeah, yeah. And it was really through talking to my dad that he was like, yeah, when we were like dating, she would have just like, her family would have one small piece of meat or fish and she would offer it to me to share. But I was like, no, you don't have enough food for your own family. I can't possibly share with you. And so I can now start to understand that.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And it's also the same actually with my dad, who didn't, you know, grow up as poor as my mum, but he would also really only share memories in a contextual setting. So if I was in Australia asking him about, you know, what was it like growing up in Malaysia, he'd give me a one-word answer.
Right.
But if I'm actually in Malaysia with him and we're walking around Malacca where he grew up, then he would offer those stories so quickly because we're there.
And the stimulus around them, yeah.
So it's interesting that, you know, in order to preserve our culture, to acknowledge our shared culture and history, we may need to find maybe the right space to do that. It's interesting though, she was touching on at the end about how globalization is also changing how we engage with our own culture. So sometimes when I think about modernity, I sort of think about, oh, everyone's living in cities now, we aren't cooking as much, and therefore culture is dying.
Right.
But she was also saying that Indonesians are now, you know, getting really involved with Korean food and other cultures.
Right.
And we're at this stage where things are becoming more multicultural, which is beautiful. We can share cultures with other people, which is again, so beautiful. But what's happening for some people is that they're engaging with other people's cultures at the expense of their own.
Right.
So that happens to me. Like, so I'm Chinese Malaysian, my heritage, that's where it is. And I sometimes expand that to being, oh, I love all aspects of Chinese culture to the point where I'm like, I love Sichuan food, right?
Right.
I want to cook it, I want to eat it all the time. Even though that's Chinese, that's actually nothing to do with my culture, which is more rooted in Cantonese,
right? Yeah.
Hokkien, and you know, the Malaysian diaspora as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm almost sacrificing learning about my own family's history at the expense of Sichuan food.
Well, it's your personal preference, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, particularly me, like, I'm quite ignorant on like even Scottish food, and I find myself, and I think most certainly Scots and probably Brits as an extension, are far more adventurous in what they cook at home, when they cook at home, or what they reheat in a microwave, because it will probably be curry or, you know, Thai green curry or something like that, whatever other kind of like dishes can be easily reheated. But
And you're saying that at the expense of their own Scottish traditions.
Yeah, because nobody's making cull and skink.
Yeah. Like, which is a delicious.
Oh, it's a hearty meal.
Yeah.
I'm looking out the window just now and it's cold and grainy and rainy, windy. And I think actually a big, you know, fish chowder would be great.
So if we go back to our food of the episode, which is coconuts, a wonderful reminder of the shared history and the seafaring traditions of the peoples of Southeast Asia, however you want to refer to them. Whichever terms you use, I think it's important to recognize that as far back as our ancient texts and our genealogy can take us, we've had shared movement of people, shared culture, shared dialogue, and we should appreciate that more.
I think you're right.
So in the next episode, we're going to continue our historical journey through Malaysia, and we're going to look at the emergence of defined territories and empires. We're going to take a look at Belacan and the forgotten ancient empires.
As long as we don't have to smoke out the kitchen in order to do this episode, I'll be more than happy to talk about it.
And we will explain that story in full with you next time. So see you next time for Satay.
Okay.